Why do we exist? Were we created with a purpose? Or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to The Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. The Universe Next Door is supported by the C.S. Lewis Society, Trinity College of Florida, and supported by gifts from listeners just like you. Discover more resources and continue the conversation at apologetics.org. And now, your host, the research professor of Bible and theology at Trinity College of Florida, author and speaker, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Welcome to The Universe Next Door, and thank you for joining us and listening to what we have to say. Mike Burhau is going to be with us for a few more weeks before Dr. Woodward comes back from his sabbatical. But Mike, how are you doing today?
I am doing well. Just getting to the start of a new school year, teaching at Calvary High School, and we are doing teacher in-service. So I've been kind of busy the last couple days.
Oh, and have you? Has your schedule changed pretty drastically because of everything with COVID in terms of starting back up? And
not yet. I mean, I think there are still some questions about what the school year is going to look like. But so far, we're just kind of playing it a week at a time. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you guys are able to do in school stuff because it's so important. I mean, online stuff is good too, but just being in a classroom, it just, in my opinion, makes so much of a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't replace that. Being able to see the faces of students and being able to have direct interaction is just much better, I think.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And now you wanted to talk about Greek philosophy today and the idea of Greek philosophy not giving rise to science. But on the other hand, contrary to what a lot of people may say, and unfortunately, what a lot of people even inside the church who are professing Christians may fall into, is that Christianity actually has given rise to a lot of what we call science today and a lot of what we do in science today. So you can take that idea and run with it, but I can't wait to see where this goes.
Yeah, there are several things that I think would be good for us to talk about maybe over the next couple podcasts. So one, just how Christianity was birthed out of a Christian environment, and we'll spend some time talking about why that's so. There have been some thinkers who have argued that that was just a historical accident. Christianity was dominant in the West, and so It was just an accident that Christianity was birthed out of that. Right. And I want to take some time to talk about how I don't think it was an accident. I think it was a direct result of Christian theology that gave rise to modern science. And so we'll spend time talking about that, and also talking about some of the myths that have been out there over the last, I mean, really well over a century. There have been myths that throughout the history of Christianity, there's been this warfare with science. So we'll spend some time addressing that claim, which is also one of these claims that's just not true. And today I thought what would be good is maybe to start with why Greek philosophy did not give rise to science and what it was about Christianity that did give rise to science. So as we go through this, I mean, it might be kind of roundabout. I don't have a logical progression to work through, but maybe we'll just have a discussion and see where we go with that.
Yeah, I think those are the most fun.
Yeah. So I guess to begin then, Greek philosophy, I mean, I do think we have a lot of respect that we can give to ancient Greek philosophy. And in some ways, you can say that we're standing on the shoulders of giants who came before us. Because in Greek philosophy, they really came up with three ways of thinking about the world that have been influential even throughout the history of Christianity, where if you go back to what are called the pre-Socratic philosophers, which these are just philosophers that came before Socrates, they were trying to figure out the nature of reality. And they wanted to figure out the nature of reality using observation and reason. And so the first three of these philosophers are a group of philosophers called the Milesian philosophers. They were from a city called Miletus. You have the most famous of these philosophers named Thales, who we hardly have any of their writings. Basically, all we know about them are just a few of the sayings that they have. But with Thales, he came up with this idea that all is water. Mm-hmm. Now, that might seem like a strange idea to us today. There's not very many people out there today that are arguing that all is water. And sometimes when I'm talking to students in the classroom and I come up with this idea, They don't even know what Thales was talking about. But I think the easiest way to connect it to today is you would have some thinkers today who think everything is physical. Now, they're not identifying exactly what the physical thing is. For Thales, he said it was water. But there's this idea that everything is physical. And at bottom, things reduce to physics. Things reduce to matter in motion. And Thales is one of the first thinkers who came up with this idea. And now you have some strange ideas and strange critiques of Thales as you're kind of working through the history of philosophy, where if everything reduces to water, then all of my thinking reduces to water. And
yeah, you have this
weird idea that water is trying to explain water. But really, everything in existence is reduced to one basic substance. And there's no distinction between me and the world. Again, if we bring that into kind of modern discussions today, we're just a part of the material physical universe, just like everything else. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what gave rise to discussions. Now, philosophers that came after Thales, many of them didn't agree with him. And they had debates about, some of them were still materialists, but they disagreed about what the substance was. So some thought it was earth, some thought it was fire, some thought it was something else. There are also a group of philosophers that were called the atomists, and they just thought that everything was reduced to an infinite number of small little atoms. So it's interesting, you know, some of the ideas that we have today, even though people who believe in atoms today weren't arguing for the same exact thing that the atomists were arguing for, a lot of these basic ideas have been recycled throughout history.
Yeah, right. I mean, I know I'm sure you'll probably get a little more into the detail, but people basically say that everything that we talk about in philosophy is some sort of like a sub idea from Socrates or Plato.
Yeah.
And so much of it is, like you said, recycled and kind of repackaged in some ways.
Yeah. Alfred North Whitehead, the famous philosopher of the early 1900s, said that really the history of philosophy is just a series of footnotes on Plato. Now that might be an overstatement, but not much. It was Plato who came along, and he divided the world into what he called the realm of the forms and the realm of the particulars. And this is really where you have the first division, where Christianity is actually going to solve a problem that Plato had. But Plato said there are really these two types of things. There are ideas that we can access with our minds. There are concepts that we can access with our minds, such as the concept of beauty. So Plato says when you know, are driving, I mean, he didn't drive, but I mean, if you were alive today, if you're driving through the Rockies and you see these huge mountains, well, you're seeing the physical mountains in front of you. But if you have this inspiration that develops inside of you and you say, this is a beautiful scene. Well, one of the things that Plato wants to do is he wants to figure out, where does that beauty exist? Is it just something that is an emotion inside of me, so it's just subjective? Or is there something that's objectively beautiful in the world? And for Plato, he says, you'll see particular things like mountains, particular events in the world. But there's also beauty, and that doesn't exist in the physical objects themselves. That exists in this what he calls the realm of the forms. So when you experience beauty, the way that you recognize beauty is your mind has access to the realm of the forms. So you can assess whether something is good, beautiful, or true because you have this access to the forms.
Yeah, and I actually, it's a really interesting thought, and you probably saw me just a few minutes ago turn around. I wasn't trying to distract you. I was just going to suggest there's a book. I couldn't think of the name of it, so I had to turn around and find it. But R.C. Sproul, who's one of my personal favorite theologians, he wrote a book called The Consequences of Ideas.
Absolutely.
And it's really just a brief history of a lot of these ideas in philosophy from a kind of a Christian perspective. Yep. So I was just going to suggest that to our listeners.
Yeah, but, I would recommend that as well. It's a very good book. And he does something that I don't know how R.C. Sproul does it, but he makes things really concise and understandable. And he covers a lot of history in a very short amount of time. So that's an excellent resource.
Yeah, no, he really does. Me and my wife were recently going through his version of systematic theology. He has it on video. So yeah, he's just such an amazing teacher.
Yeah.
but he puts things so clearly. But anyway, that's just a really helpful book, and it's brief. So if you're not a major in philosophy, it's helpful to just kind of go over these things and be able to reference back to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, then, so as the story of Greek philosophy continues, then, so you have Plato, who divides the world between the forms and the what he calls the particulars, the particular events and objects of the world that we see. He has a famous student called Aristotle. And Aristotle very much had respect for Plato, had a ton of respect for Plato, but he disagreed in a significant way. He did agree with this idea that there is this idea of forms that exists, but he didn't want to separate the forms from the material substances themselves. So the forms exist inside of each material object. Mm-hmm. Now, this becomes interesting when we think about the history of science, because a lot of science after Aristotle, and at this time, they didn't call it science. They just called it natural philosophy. But a lot of natural philosophy after Aristotle traced their roots back to Aristotle. And there is a huge misconception that exists out there that I remember hearing about when I was in college, that Christians throughout the history of, say, science and religion, Christians oftentimes were holding science back. It was Christianity that was, science was trying to progress, but religious dogma was keeping science down for centuries. And when I actually learned the real history, what I realized is that it was actually Aristotle who was holding science back for a long time. Now, again, Aristotle did many great things. I mean, he formalized many of the different disciplines that we have today, biology, logic. He's responsible for categorical logic, which is really important. But he had one idea when he had his conception of the forms. And I won't be able to go into a lot of detail here, but when he thought of, in Plato's idea of the forms, and I think Aristotle is similar to this, when you look at, say, the form of a circle, so I have the listeners won't be able to see this, but I have a cup here, and you can see this particular circle on the top of my cup. Plato said, and I think Aristotle would agree with this, that this is just one particular example of a circle. Now, for Aristotle, circleness is within the objects themselves.
Yeah.
But if you have something that is an oval doesn't exist in the realm of the forms. An oval is just an imperfect circle. So the real pure form is a circle. Now, this came into an idea for many Aristotelian natural philosophers or Aristotelian scientists, such as Ptolemy. When he was looking at the heavens, he thought that the planets, the objects that we see going around in the sky, out there is more perfect than down here on Earth. So we might see imperfect circles here on Earth, but certainly the heavenly bodies, if they're orbiting the Earth, they're orbiting in perfect circles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an idea that we maybe wouldn't click with much today, but that presupposition that the idea of perfection must be a perfect circle and not an ellipsis or not an oval influenced a lot of astronomy for hundreds of years. And this actually produced some problems because people like Ptolemy and other scientists that came after them, when they were observing the heavenly bodies would do some strange things. As they were tracing them and taking detailed records of what was going on in the sky, there were moments where it appeared as though the heavenly bodies would stop and then they would go back and then they would go forward again. Well, how are we going to explain this? Well, according to Aristotelian presuppositions, they came up with number one, a geocentric model of the universe, which means the Earth is at the center of the solar system. But when they saw, the motion going back, they called it retrograde motion. They tried to explain that with perfect circles. So a body would go in the sky and then it would make a perfect circle and then it would go on again. And everything in their models were perfect circles and they were all operating. They were trying to fit the data within Aristotelian presuppositions. And it was really Christians that came along that started to say, well, we're not followers of Aristotle. we're followers of the rational God of the Bible. And if we want to know how God designs the universe, let's not start with, you know, Aristotle's ideas of what perfection is. Mm-hmm. Let's start with God. And the way we know what God thinks is we have to observe the natural universe on its own terms. And we want to discover the data and not try to make it fit within some sort of preconceived framework.
So because the because they believed that God had created everything and created a natural order to everything, there's purpose in studying that natural order. Like there's no need to look at something and observe something and try to convince yourself that God did it. Because if you believe that God's already the starting point, then we're just actually observing nature itself. There's no, what's the term? There's no need to reorder it. There's no need to try to make it fit into a specific system because we can just look at nature itself.
Right. Yeah. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to describe the world as it actually is. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the world's going to surprise us. I mean, right. this actually gave rise to empirical observation. It's like studying the Bible. So you have people like Augustine who's saying there's the book of nature and there's the book of scripture. Well, sometimes when you read the Bible, there are things in the Bible that surprise you. There are things in scripture where you're reading it and you're thinking, if I were God, I wouldn't do it that way. Now I think when you read the Bible and that happens, I think that's actually a healthy thing because that means, number one, you're not God.
Yeah.
And it means that you have a genuine relationship with scripture. You're allowing scripture to correct your thinking. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what these early Christian scientists wanted to do with the natural world. They said there might be some things in the natural world that surprise us, but we're not going to try to reorder the universe to conform to our thinking. We want to get our thinking to conform to God's thinking.
Right. And it's unfortunate that even to this day, and as I referenced earlier, even Christians fall into this trap of thinking that science and Christianity are pitted against each other. And you either believe one or the other. And in reality, it's like without Christianity, we don't know the majority, I would say, of the stuff that we know about science and the processes that we do science today, we wouldn't have otherwise.
Right.
Without Christian believers throughout history. And so I think it's just such a misunderstanding. And actually, I can't think of where, but I know C.S. Lewis actually wrote about what you were just discussing, that this idea of the orbit of the Earth and the sun actually goes way back to early Greek philosophy.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does. Well, and what's interesting, so where this came up in my college days was I remember hearing this story that, again, the church was the institution that was arguing that the Earth was at the center. And then Copernicus comes along and he wants to say, no, the sun is at the center of the solar system. And then the church got into a warfare with Copernicus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting is that has no basis in history whatsoever.
Yeah.
The reality is actually Copernicus was wrong. Many people don't know this, but Copernicus was still operating using Aristotelian presuppositions. So he was arguing that everything must orbit using perfect circles. And during this time, he came in front of a body of natural philosophers, scientists who were studying the astronomy, and he was putting his model up against Ptolemy's model. So everyone was following Ptolemy's model at the time. And both models had perfect circles. What was different with Copernicus's model and Ptolemy's model is when you start with the assumption that the sun is at the center, Copernicus actually had to draw more epicycles than did Ptolemy. And that's why his ideas were rejected. It was the scientific community of his day that said, well, your model is more complicating than Ptolemy's model. And were buying into the idea of Occam's razor at the time. Like if you have two models, you want to go with the simplest model. And mm-hmm. Ptolemy's model was more simple. It really wasn't until we got to Kepler that he came up with the idea that maybe if we just, again, study the universe and we start with the idea that the Earth is at the center, if we allow the planets to move in elliptical orbits and not perfect circles, then maybe it makes sense to put the sun at the center. And it was his idea. And then later it was confirmed by Galileo, but Kepler was saying, we astronomers, we're just thinking God's thoughts after him. And so mm-hmm. his model describing the universe as it is with an elliptical motions of the planets that fit the data much more than did Ptolemy and much more than Copernicus did.
Wow. Yeah, that I didn't know that. That's really interesting. I knew that there was something about that, but I hadn't actually looked too far into it. And I know you mentioned earlier that while we're on this topic, you mentioned that oftentimes people will make the claim that, oh, well, everybody was Christian back then, so it was just by default. But I think, I mean, two things. Number one, you're kind of pointing out that it's actually they're using their Christian worldview to apply to science. It's not just they happen to be Christian and they happen to be doing science. It's that they're actually looking at science through the lens of the Christian worldview. And the second thing, you may have seen this, it was years back, but Richard Dawkins and John Lennox, in one of their debates, Dawkins brought up this question or the statement. He said, oh, well, everybody was Christian back then, so that's the only reason. And right. John Lennox pointed out, like, wait a minute, no, they weren't. What about China?
Right.
They weren't Christian. Everybody was not Christian back then.
Right.
And so I think it's just so important as Christians to recognize that sometimes people will borrow from our worldview. They'll do this in terms of morality, in terms of science, even in terms of claiming that we can think logically. You're having to borrow from Christianity and having to suggest that there's not a mind behind what we're doing, even though that's the only thing that makes sense. But it's important to recognize that oftentimes when people critique Christianity, they're borrowing from Christianity in order to do so.
Absolutely. And if you ask, so what are the Christian presuppositions that gave rise to science? You've mentioned some of them already. But what made Christianity unique than Greek philosophy was Christianity began with this idea that there is a rational mind who is capable of ordering the cosmos. Mm-hmm. And if this rational mind orders the cosmos, then that gives us reason to think that the cosmos is intelligible, that we can learn something about it. The heavens declare the glory of God, so we can read the heavens. We can learn something about it.
Right.
But that same God creates us in his image, which is why there's a correspondence between my thinking and the universe, is because I'm created in the image of this rational God. And so the way that the scientists said it is that God's thoughts prescribe the universe. God's thoughts make the universe rational like it is. And then my thoughts describe the universe. And that was the foundation for science.
Right. That's really helpful to understand. So we only have a little bit less than 2 minutes left, but you know, taking that thought, what can we leave our listeners with in terms of like maybe getting into a conversation about these things? How can they sort of go, what angle can they go at that conversation? Let's say, especially if they're talking to somebody who's maybe more intelligent or knowledgeable in the area of science, like how could our listeners go and bring some of these things up in a discussion and also be confident?
Yeah, well, there's two things. So the first thing that I would say is you should read about this history. I mean, there's plenty of good resources out there. We just had Stephen Meyer on last week, and his book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, is an excellent resource. He goes through this history in a very compelling way in his book. Another book, this is kind of a classic book that I recommend to people, Nancy Piercy's book, The Soul of Science. The subtitle is Christian Faith and Natural Philosophy. She does a great job walking through the history of how Christianity gave rise to science. And so I would say it's helpful to just learn about this history, number one. But then number two, when you're talking with somebody in a conversation, an actual conversation, I find that it's really helpful to ask questions. So if I'm engaging with somebody who thinks that there's a conflict between Christianity and science, the three questions that I like to ask first is, and I get these from Greg Kokel. I think they're really helpful questions. The one type of question is, well, what do you mean by that? Or could you give me an example of where there's a conflict? And you just, I mean, this all starts with you having some background knowledge. So if you don't have background knowledge, this is harder. Number two, how did you come to that conclusion? Like, what are some resources that you have read that have given you this information? And then it's the third question where you ask, well, what do you think about this idea? Or I read this book the other day. What do you think about this? And so the questions are, what do you mean by that? How did you come to this conclusion? And have you ever considered this idea? And those are just good ways of engaging in a conversation.
Well, I think those are extremely helpful. If you've maybe wanted to go back and look at some of this stuff and you're listening on the radio, go check out the Universe Next Door podcast. You can actually download this and listen to it whenever you want. But thank you so much again, Dr. Mike Berhau, for being here and running this show. And thank you for listening to the Universe Next Door.